In search of adventure, Connor Grennan traded his day job for a year-long trip around the globe. What began as a lark became a passionate commitment that would transform his life and the lives of countless others. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the second half hour, we'll listen back to my conversation from last year with Connor Grennan, author of Little Princes. He'll tell us about his work with Nepalese children who were victims of child trafficking. Before that, a conversation with Kevin Connolly, a photographer who was born without legs. His memoir, Double Take, includes candid pictures of people during his travels around the world reacting to him. A legless man zooming by on a skateboard. That's all coming up this hour, right after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Great to have you with us for this encore edition of the program. This hour, we examine our reactions to the disabled. From the moment he began to move, Kevin Connolly has seen the world from an amended perspective. Kevin was born in 1985 in Montana. He was also born without legs. Now 24 years old, Kevin has competed and won several awards in mono skiing at the X Games. He's also traveled the world on a skateboard, photographing people staring at him. In fact, his photo project, The Rolling Exhibition, was shown at the Smithsonian. I spoke with Kevin in March of 2010 in advance of an appearance he was making in Des Moines to promote his book, and I asked him about competing in the X Games as a mono skier in January of that same year.
This would be my fifth time, and it was the last weekend of January, and the course that they set this year was just far more burly than anything else I'd seen. They had 16 guys selected, six dropped out, and then one broke a collarbone, another cracked some ribs, and I was unfortunate enough to fracture a vertebrae on my second day of practice. So it was a burly event.
So what does that feel like, fracture a vertebrae? What is that feeling like now?
It's feeling fine now. To be honest, it happened during the second day of practice, so it's arguable that I was certainly skiing on it the rest of that week. Mm-hmm. And I was just kind of so sore throughout my entire body from just, you know, abuse and stress and everything that it took a week for the pain to even, like, localize and me figure out what was going on.
Right.
But it's getting better now, eating ibuprofen like candy.
So what category do you ski in, Kevin?
It's called the Mono X, or the Mono Skier Cross. And the really cool thing to note is that I'm sure a lot of people have seen, especially, you know, with the ending of the Winter Olympics, have seen the Skier Cross course before, which is, you know, the one where people go down at the same time and they have to go around these gates, but it's mostly, you know, big jumps and kind of whoop-de-woo sort of things. We ride on the exact same course that those other athletes do. And so we had features ranging between 30 feet, and then the last one threw us out maybe 110 feet. And you have four mono skiers going down with various disabilities. Some are paraplegic, some don't have legs. It's just, you know, largely based on competence and skill on the course.
Mm-hmm.
So that, in a nutshell, is the event. It's kind of like a weird cross between snowmobile racing, you know, with the big heavy machines we're running, and skier cross.
Double Take is the title of your new memoir. This is the first book you've written, isn't it, Kevin?
Yeah.
Well, you're 23. You haven't taken that long to write your first book. You're only 23 years old.
24.
24.
Hey, I got to fight for every year I can get now.
Fascinating memoir. I read it over the weekend. It took me a day. I was glued to it for an entire day. It's wonderful. Fascinating.
Well, thank you.
Fascinating to glimpse life through your eyes. What made you write it?
You know, it was one of those things where I was working on the photo series that kind of informed a lot of the book through my junior and senior year of college. And when I got out, I always had the intent to try and publish those photographs, but it was really my now editor and publisher. When I first met them, they really stood out to me apart from all the other people I'd met and you know, were able to convince me. They're like, you know, we understand what you're trying to say with this photo series, but ultimately you have more to say about that, your experiences in Montana, growing up with your family.
Mm-hmm.
All of those things inform your later life. And so, you know, it was my editor and my publisher, who were very generous with their time. They let me move out to New York and work in their office next to them, you know, all to try and make this thing happen, which, yeah, it was at a young age.
You start your memoir at the very beginning of your life with your birth and the reaction of your parents. Tell us about that, because it was through this project, through this writing project, I understand that you had to have an awkward, what you said was an awkward conversation about, Mom, Dad, how did you really feel when you saw your baby born and the baby had no legs?
Yeah, and I mean, I think that was largely the biggest hurdle that I faced when I was writing this book, was that, you know, a 24-year-old guy from Montana, or a 23-year-old guy from Montana at the time I was writing it, you know, you're not necessarily predisposed to just kind of throwing yourself emotionally out on the table. So, yeah, that was definitely the biggest hurdle. And I mean, quite literally, that first couple pages of the first chapter when I'm calling my folks, I mean, that's exactly what's happening. I'm just on the phone going, all right, we just got to do this. And, you know, as I'm sure in the book it shows, you know, my folks, if there's one thing they are, it's incredibly open. And, you know, the more I got into it and the more I started to learn about my early life, you know, the easier it became to keep going and to, you know, open up more and more. It was definitely hard at first, though.
How did they characterize, I think you asked your mom, what it was like those first few moments of having a legless kid?
Yeah, she said, I think the line you're referring to was, she said, you were an exclamation point on a really tough couple of years, which in context was she just lost her father and her oldest sister to cancer. And I think my dad the day before had just been fired from his job at the lumber yard. And, you know, the next day, August 18th, when I was born, was also her birthday. So, you know, after all that and 24 hours later, you know, 24 hours of labor, I'm sorry, this legless kid pops out. I would imagine it'd be quite a shock for anybody.
Mm.
Especially when you don't know, you know, the next 20 chapters of the story.
Right. Kevin, when do you first remember being aware that you were legless?
It's a good question. I would say, you know, it's always kind of been to varying degrees, but, and a lot of people don't necessarily believe this when I tell them, but, you know, I would say not until sixth grade or something.
Sixth grade.
And I think school dances really drove home the point more than anything else. But, you know, you got to keep in mind that prior to that, I was growing up in a reasonably small town in Montana. So, you know, you have this tiny community that, you know, once they acclimate to who you are, you know everybody, things are familiar. I think that I had a really normal childhood.
Hmm. So the stairs that you document in your photographic exhibition and in this book were not stairs that you would get. You got those once you got out of your hometown of Bozeman.
Absolutely. I actually grew up in Helena. Bozeman is where I went for school. I mean, they're kind of neighboring towns, so it's not not that much of a difference. But, yeah, I mean, that's you're 100% right. It was my sophomore year of college when I went to study abroad in New Zealand for a year and kind of was really just out trekking on my own, and then went to Ukraine and Austria and a couple other places just to travel, that I really became exposed, you know, to the number of different reactions people had to me that didn't know me.
Let's back up a little bit, Kevin. Of course, after your birth, the big question your family had was, and you yourself later in life had, was why? What could we have done, you ask in the book, to have caused this? And this is a question, interestingly, that was written all over the faces of those you photographed later in life. Do you know the reason this happened?
No, it's totally sporadic. CDC doesn't have any stats on it or anything else. I mean, to have a kid that basically had his femurs, you know, not grow, so pelvis and everything is fine, and is otherwise a totally healthy baby is a really rare thing. Mm. One of the important things I'd like to note on that though, is, you know, I think the talent that my folks really had, and the thing that was really important was that, you know, they really only maybe asked that question once. It wasn't a lingering conundrum or anything like that. You know, we were always very focused on, you know, the logistics and the present.
Right.
And that was, you know, that was a really successful model for us.
Well, you mentioned the logistics. You note in your book that your dad was a big fan of MacGyver, this TV series. If our listeners aren't sure or didn't live during the time of MacGyver, he's a guy who invented all kinds of things from household items. And this turned out to be a lucky thing for you that your dad loved MacGyver. Explain.
Well, you know, I think one of the other things to know, on top of, you know, my dad's infatuation with MacGyver and, you know, his whole interest with this show was, you know, this guy's ability to build, you know, pretty innovative things that were immediately necessary using kind of nothing but, you know, whatever you could find laying around. Coming from Montana, not necessarily being around, you know, large hospitals all the time and really leading a rural lifestyle, that, you know, very much fit into our ethos of, you know, what we wanted or, you know, how they wanted to raise me. So, you know, he was watching that for tips on, you know, effectively kind of how to retrofit the house for me without necessarily diving into prosthetics or a wheelchair. So, you know, his MacGyverisms were, you know, installing simple stuff, keeping me from falling in the toilet when I was like 2 years old by cutting a smaller hole on the lid, installing a lower handlebar on the stairs. Probably the best, though, I think, was the invention of the butt shoe, which really just came about from the fact that, you know, in Montana, with all the snow that's on the ground and how much time we spent camping and outdoors every summer, a wheelchair just wouldn't cut it. So from my earliest memory, I just ran around on my hands. I don't think I even saw a wheelchair until I was 10 years old.
Mm. Now, I feel, I mean, this is an incredibly funny memoir. I was laughing out loud many times while reading it, Kevin. But I also had this nagging feeling that I don't know if I should be laughing out loud or laughing at all. For instance, your line, you mentioned the toilet seat that your dad said was his personal favorite of the invention for you. He said, "Dad said it was great because he didn't have to pull me out of the john in the middle of the night." Now, there's a great laugh line, but is it all right to laugh?
I think you should totally laugh.
Totally laugh. It's all right. Okay, I'll let it out. A big villain.
You know, it's pretty funny. We've always had a really dark sense of humor, and you know, my dad is kind of a foul mouth guy, or comes across as a little foul mouth in the book. And you know, he's way worse. You know, than he comes across on the page. You know, and a lot of that just stems from our ability to kind of laugh at everything. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that goes hand in hand with what I was saying earlier, with, you know, not asking the why me question for all that long.
Yeah.
You know, I think that some of that early stuff, writing about the things that were difficult for me as a kid, was tough to write at the time. Just, you know, basically to say, yeah, I fell in the toilet when I was 2 years old as a rough and tumble dude in his mid-20s. That was tough. But no, I think it was all meant to be approached with a good amount of humor.
Kevin Connolly is the author of the book Double Take, a memoir which documents his life growing up without legs. And we're listening back to a conversation I had with him in March of 2010.
Initially, you had artificial limbs, courtesy of the Shriners Hospital. Mm-hmm. By the end of third grade, you had given up these prosthetic legs. Why?
You know, I think that the key thing to in your mind's eye, if you're thinking about this legless guy, the key thing to remember is that I didn't have stumps, right? So there was no femur or anything like that, which is effectively how you would naturally create like a bipedal gait, you know, how most people walk. Since I didn't have that, it was kind of like this just big bucket that you would try your best to swing these gangly stilts. I mean, they looked like legs. They had shoes, jeans, everything else. But, you know, weighing in at 30 pounds and, you know, being, you know, these heavy kind of gangly things that were actually bigger than you in reality, made for really awkward movement. You know, I could run on my hands about 4 or 5 times faster than I could, you know, jump in these legs and try and for the purpose of looking normal. So, you know, the question that I think I posed in the book was, you know, how long would you be willing to wear stilts in order to look like everybody else? And I mean, the reality is we're all pretty lazy. We'd give it up after a week.
You write in your book, Kevin, the wheelchair brought about the first realization that I was disabled. So these prosthetic legs didn't work. The wheelchair worked better. But you realized then first that you were disabled.
Yeah. You know, and I think that that's the really interesting thing. You know, what does a wheelchair connote in our time? And you know, I mean, you got to keep in mind that I grew up thinking that I was just short. I kind of knew that I was missing legs or a little slower than, say, my sisters. But, you know, running around on my hands, I always was really taught to view myself as whole. And, you know, jumping into a wheelchair, it was kind of, you know, this initial shock to my system of, well, this is, you know, what I always saw other people in the hospitals and stuff. You know, why am I all of a sudden in this thing? And, you know, it did. You're right. It was kind of this double-edged sword in that it provided assistance that, you know, really was necessary when you're changing classes and having to carry books and all that. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, on the other hand, it did kind of force me not necessarily to view myself in a different light, but to certainly grapple with it.
I found it fascinating to see how people reacted to the wheelchair, because it really stands out what the wheelchair means. Because the skateboard became your favorite mode of transportation. And let's get it straight here. You can book on this thing in the city, right?
Yeah, I mean, I can go about as fast as a cyclist in the city. I mean, I can in New York, when I was writing the book, I mean, I could make it from, you know, Grand Central to the Lower East Side in 25 minutes, 20 minutes. I mean, you can cover a ton of ground. To comment more on the difference of those two things, you know, I really took to the longboard because that was, you know, my thing. I love the immediate and, you know, the logistics and the practicality of that mode of transport. But I think that, you know, riding on the skateboard, for me, which was, you know, purely a logistic reason, for others really carried a lot of maybe mixed messages around the world. I mean, when I'm in a wheelchair, I get far less attention than when I'm on a skateboard, ironically enough.
It raises, you point out in the book, it raises a lot of questions like, why is he riding that thing? Can't he afford a wheelchair? Is this guy homeless?
Exactly. And I think that, you know, we've been maybe not taught, but quite possibly conditioned to think, oh, you're disabled, you get in a wheelchair. That's, you know, the social script you follow. And I just never really had any interest in that and didn't really realize the full extent of the disruption that I might cause until, you know, I was kind of out in the world.
Now, some of the darkest humor in your book is when you were 17 years old, your description of your involvement in the vigilante parade in downtown Helena?
Yeah, the vigilante parade.
Do you dare tell us about that?
Yeah. Well, it's the first thing to note is that, you know, the floats are entirely by high schoolers. So that should give you – it's not a Macy's Day Parade. Let's put it that way.
Right.
All these high school kids are given a day or two off from school to construct a parade float that has something to do, regardless of how tangential, to Montana's history. And the one that myself and some of my buddies picked was, you know, vaguely just frontier medicine, which is kind of, you know, a loose excuse to get to saw off a leg. So we made these, I guess you could put it in quotes, prosthetic legs, except, you know, unlike the fancy ones that Shriners made, these were made out of, you know, wood and a couple nails that we cobbled together. And then we lined up, shot some arrows into them, you know, fit these fake prosthetic legs onto me, threw me on the top of this gurney sort of thing, and started rolling through town. The important thing to note, though, was we had kind of a brainy kid on our side who was able to rig up this compressor and run these tubes up through my leg that shot blood, I think I want to say like 30 feet in the air. I mean, we pumped a good, I forget the exact quote of the number of gallons, but I know it was like three times the amount that the human body can hold. But yeah, no, we had a number of buckets of blood under the table just shooting out and just covering everybody.
So what do you remember about the faces you saw of the onlookers at that parade?
Well, I mean, this is the thing, is that, like, on the one hand, you know, that sounds really gory and darkly, you know, pretty dark. But, you know, there's something, I don't know what the deal is. I can't comment on the general mental state of most Helenans. But, you know, they all thought it was pretty funny. The majority of people that I saw were laughing. I did catch, by the end of it, there were a couple old guys who gave us some nasty looks for what we were doing. But I think the majority were all right.
And at the end of that chapter, you apologize to the people of the town because you certainly ruined a good number of clothes.
Yeah, that was one of the things I forgot to mention. Well, we were searching how to concoct this, you know, blood thing, or, you know, all these gallons of blood, and we had to figure out a way to just make this as cheap as possible. And so we went to, I think, the local Walmart or whatever, and we're looking for different kinds of dye. And by far and away, the cheapest was RIT clothing dye. Right. And with the amount that we had to create, that's what we ended up buying. And I will say, though, because I did put myself up on the chopping block in, as kind of an apology, I had a reading in Helena about that, and it was maybe 200 or 300 people showed up, and I actually read that chapter. So the apology, to my credit, was given in person.
Right. Maybe some of the people in the audience who had to throw away some clothes were actually
there.
Yeah,
I was expecting, like, you know, a coffee cup or something to get thrown in my direction, but no, nothing.
Kevin, some of the most heart-wrenching moments I found in your book are your accounts in the elementary school age, where where kids actually don't hide it the way adults try to, but they say what's on their minds. They don't hide their reactions. An encounter with a bunch of kids at a McDonald's playground, for instance, a fight with a boy named Trevor in your school playground. What, for you, stands out as a sort of a really painful incident for you?
You know, I think a harder one, you know, aside from being called different or you know, getting beat up on, which is bad, but not, I don't think, all that necessarily unique. Certainly having not having legs is unique, but I think that that unfortunately is the treatment that a lot of other people have gotten. I think the thing that was really painful for me was actually the other part of that chapter when I was getting denied trying to ask this girl out. Mm. You know, especially early on, you know, when you're kind of playing the dating game in middle school, which is, you know, more of a farce than anything else, you know, it's super, super shallow. So you're just striking out left and right. And I know I'm kind of putting a bit of gloss on that. But yeah, I think realizing that I was different in the eyes of girls just at the time when I was becoming interested in them was probably one of the harder parts of growing up.
Also, you wanted to play sports mainly to fit in. But you realized that some sports were just out of the question, football or basketball. But you thought, theoretically, before trying it out, wrestling might work because of your advantage. You had tremendous upper body strength compared to the other kids, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean yeah, that was the idea. You're running around on your arms. Ostensibly, you're going to be good on the mat. But one of the things that I failed to take into account was, you know, leverage. And it doesn't really matter how strong you are. I mean, if someone can tower over you and kind of plop themselves down on you, you know, I've heard of a couple guys without legs who are have done much better for themselves. So I could have just been terrible as well.
But you did just discover your sport, skiing, mono skiing.
Yeah. Actually, it was the year that I was quitting wrestling or just kind of getting in the midst of trying to eke out the end of the season. I think I was taken out for my first time on the hill, and it was just a once-off thing. But I was immediately hooked, and the next year kind of enrolled, not full-time, but was coming down every week. And, yeah, I just really, really fell in love with it. As to why, I think it was just, you know, I got to go fast and hang out with a lot of guys called dirtbags who were just kind of cool, roughneck, older construction guys who were ski bums.
Kevin, this has been wonderful. I want to thank you very much for this conversation. It's been a real delight.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much as well.
Kevin Connolly is the author of the memoir Double Take, which documents his life without legs. He's a silver and bronze medalist mono skier in the X Games. And he's also traveled the world on a skateboard, documenting the reactions of people through his photographs. The resulting rolling exhibition has been on display in the Smithsonian, and I spoke with him in 2010 in advance of an appearance in Des Moines to promote his book. Coming up, we listen back to another interview with a young author. Connor Grennan talks about his book, Little Princes, which is an account of his efforts to help Nepalese children who are victims of human trafficking. That's as River to River continues from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Ben Kiefer with River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Today you're listening to an encore edition of the program. Connor Grennan is the author of Little Princes. It's a memoir which tells the story of Grennan's time spent volunteering at the Little Princes Orphanage in Nepal and the discovery that many of the orphans he had been living with and caring for were not orphans at all. The children had been rescued from human traffickers who had duped their parents into thinking they would be taken from their war-torn villages and given a better life. Grennan went on to found a not-for-profit organization called Next Generation Nepal, which reunites the children with their families. I began by asking him about his initial motivation for volunteering at the orphanage.
My initial intention actually wasn't really to volunteer as much as it was just to travel, and volunteer was sort of became part and parcel of that when I felt, you know, a little bit guilty about not volunteering when I was doing all this traveling. So, you know, part of it was my friends kind of guilting me into it, and part of it was really just thinking that it would kind of be a good pickup line for women if I volunteered in an orphanage in Nepal. So unfortunately, my intentions, you know, at the outset were no more noble than that, I'm afraid.
It's really interesting in your book how you describe your first impressions of the orphanage. I wonder if you can recall some of those images for us now.
When I first walked in there, I had this impression of what an orphanage in Nepal might look like, and I thought of it as a, you know, sad place, a place where there were kids just sort of sitting in corners and not really doing much because they were orphans, like I might see on some kind of commercial for sponsoring a child. But in fact, it turned out to be completely different. I mean, as it turns out, kids are pretty much the same no matter where you go. And I walked in this orphanage expecting one image and came out, you know, with them just piling on top of me and just kind of going crazy and just wanting, you know, attention like 6, 7, 8-year-olds want anywhere around the world.
And how did they view you initially?
You know, when they found out that I was American, you know, they had some images about America that they didn't really understand, and they were just curious about the outside world, I think. I mean, it was very interesting sort of in the beginning to be in a conversation with them, sort of, you know, just a basic conversation with them, and reference, you know, the ocean or something, and find out that they had never seen the ocean. They didn't even know what it was or what it looked like, and trying to describe a body of water to, you know, these kids that lived in this, you know, high landlocked country that was so large you couldn't even see the other side. And it was just incredible, almost culture shock right off the bat.
You discovered that many of these boys and girls at Little Princess were not, in fact, orphans. They were victims rescued from human traffickers.
Yeah.
When did you realize they were not orphans?
After I'd volunteered and decided to come back a year later. And, you know, one day I was there with the kids in early 2006, and this woman came kind of down the path to the orphanage, and we were in this little village outside Kathmandu, and just knocked on the gate, and we let her in, kind of confused as to what somebody would be doing visiting this orphanage. And she said, I believe you have two of my children here. And we were just sort of, you know, blown away, really. But she told us this entire story about how, you know, all these parents were, you know, living in the mountains, and the Maoist rebels had begun to take over the villages in Nepal one by one over the last 10 years and had taken to a practice of actually abducting children to put into the rebel army. And parents were desperate to save them, and so they ended up giving them to these men who were promising them a better life, who would say, oh, I'll take your child to the Kathmandu Valley, and they'll get an education, and they'll be safe from the Maoists, and they'll come back in 10 years. And parents would pay for this privilege. They would pay extraordinary amounts of money, essentially their life savings for what it's worth, and give the child up.
It's funny that, I mean, you have a very open relationship with these kids, these boys and girls, but that you found it out from someone outside and that none of the boys or girls ever shared that with you. How did these 7 and 8-year-olds feel about their circumstances?
Well, this was really one of the most stunning things for me as well. I mean, you know, one of the first things that I did after I learned this story was go to the kids who I knew very well at this point. We've been living with them for months and say, you know, how come you didn't tell us, you know, that this was happening? And as it turned out, the trafficker who, you know, whose control they were under before they came to us, you know, would beat them. This trafficker made a lot of money on them, not just selling them, but putting them up for international adoption. He could make a lot of money that way. So if it came out that they weren't real orphans, this trafficker could get in trouble. He would also send them out to beg on the streets to tourists who would come through to do climbing or trekking or whatever. And it was just, you know, sort of more, sort of it would engender more sympathy from tourists if they said they were real orphans. So they could never tell the truth. And it was so deeply ingrained in them that even for us, who they trusted, they just never told us.
If they had not been rescued, what would have then their future been like?
Well, unfortunately, we've seen that in a lot of kids. I mean, there's thousands of kids in these situations. Unfortunately, some of them don't survive. An organization that I started through this recently rescued about 20 kids, but if we'd gotten to them a few months earlier from this trafficker, we would have been rescuing 22 kids. Other kids are sold into slavery, into hotels or brick factories or to wealthy families. We've seen a lot of the young girls be sent down to India for prostitution. You know, in the end, the scariest thing to me about all this is that they are completely cut off from their families, their communities, abandoned in Kathmandu or sold into slavery without ever having a chance to get back to their families, who are so deep in the mountains they might as well be on the other side of the moon. And that's the problem we're really trying to address.
As you mentioned, Connor, at the start of this, you were not looking to be a do-gooder. You didn't see yourself as a global humanitarian. You had a comfortable life. Then this visit to Nepal changed everything. What was it about these children that touched you so deeply? I mean, before this, you, as everyone knows, there are children in great need.
Yeah, I mean, this is a great point. I really fell in love with the kids. But I think what really, for me, kind of turned me around on this was a couple of instances, really, which I relate in the book. One being the fact that, when the war broke out and the revolution broke out, and I had to leave the country, right in that time, we had 7 children stolen from us by a trafficker. And this was about as horrific as you can imagine. Kids that I knew very well. I emailed and called everybody I knew in Nepal saying, look, can you find these kids? Can you find these kids? But everybody has, is overburdened with the work they're trying to do in Nepal. There was just nobody that could really take on that burden. And so that's when I realized, wow, if I don't go back and look for those kids are goners. And I knew that. And these were young kids. And so it was more out of a sense of, if I don't do this, nobody's going to do it. And I was the one that showed up. And so I truly believe that, if you have a chance to read the book, you'll see that a lot of people in my position would have done the same thing.
So what sets you apart from those who didn't get involved is the fact that the mere doing of the act.
Well, that is exactly it. The only difference between me and, the other guy is that I happened to show up. I showed up and I kind of got involved and I continued to just stay involved. That's the funny thing about volunteering. I always thought of volunteering as something that people did who were the kind of person that volunteered, that they just wanted to help other people. They were passionate about some specific cause. And I was pretty much the exact opposite of that. But I did show up, and it's the showing up, it's the starting to volunteer that actually gives you the passion and the skill and the compassion to help these kids and people and causes that really need that kind of help.
You describe these children. Also, in your book, you have a lot of pictures of just delightful faces to look at. It's easy to see why you fell in love with these kids. But I was struck also in reading it about the resourcefulness of these kids. Tell us, if you could, about the time that you actually bought little cars for all of them.
Yeah, this is. I made blunders almost every single day that I was out there. But one of my favorites was the fact that I thought I was kind of coming in and finally giving them toys, because all the toys they made, they made out of trash and everything. I was like, oh, these poor kids making trash, into toys. And so I bought them 18 little Matchbox cars, and I think it was probably within 2 hours that these cars were just smashed to bits. And they brought me back the little pieces and said, oh, can you fix these cars? And, I was thinking, I guess I can, put it in an envelope and mail it to, Mattel or something, but I can't fix it. And they were like, well, what's the use of it when it breaks, you can't fix it? I'm like, but I don't know, actually. And so, immediately I started to get the realization that, just because you buy something and just because somebody else manufactures it, it doesn't make it a better toy. And then they went back to their own little cars that they'd made out of bottles and nails and tops of bottles and everything else as wheels. And they were thrilled. They were happy as anything. So it was just sort of a learning lesson, as there were many of.
When you returned to Nepal and found out these were not, in fact, orphans, but children rescued from human traffickers, you set out to find the parents of these children, as you said, in the mountains there. Tell us about that.
The first thing I did was start to search for these 7 children who had been stolen from us. I didn't know how to do it, but I just kind of got on the back of a motorcycle and just went and found hundreds of children who were, in these dire conditions in these illegal orphanages, and one by one started to find those kids and realize, as I started to find them, and they were in really bad shape, some of them were, you know, almost in a coma from malnutrition, I realized I would have to find their families. I had to get them back. These were young children. So I thought, well, I know that they're out there somewhere. I know that they're deep in the mountains, and I know that it's physically possible to get there, even if it's difficult. So I basically flew a plane as deep into the mountains as I could, just on the border with Tibet, really, where, you know, this is a place where there's no roads, no electricity, no light bulbs, no phones, nothing. I mean, it's as if you're gone back in 300 years. People walk around with fire on sticks. And I put on a backpack, and I found a guide, and I just walked through the mountains for about 4 weeks with just photos of the children to the villages. And one by one, I started to actually track down the parents that had lost their children years before.
And you put your life at risk at some times.
Yeah, you know, I mean, not on purpose, you know, like it's, I didn't know what to expect. And I was, you know, woefully, you know, unskilled and ill-prepared for this kind of job. And I found myself down there at times where there was, you know, still Maoist activity down there. There were still people that had arms there, even though the Civil War had just ended. You know, and it was also just the terrain. I found myself having to walk through the night along these cliff walls and getting, you know, desperately sick. And it was just, you know, it's an inhospitable place. But I knew that I couldn't, you know, just let these kids sort of just go on, you know, for the rest of their life and end up who knows where. So I just tried to do it, and then I ended up being able to do it.
Connor Grennan is my guest. He's the author of Little Princes, and Connor Grennan returned to Nepal to found Next Generation Nepal. That's a nonprofit organization dedicated to reconnecting trafficked children with their families in post-war Nepal. I don't know if I'm pronouncing this correctly. Golka. The name of the man who trafficked many of these children. Tell us about him.
Yeah, this is the guy that's sort of, you know, for lack of a better word, the big villain in the book. I mean, this is a man that has trafficked so many of these children because he's realized what a great living you can make off it. I mean, imagine he just takes 20 kids from these families. He gets the life savings of all these families. And then, you know, even better, he uses the kids to make money. You know, these were kids that he really harmed. He really made them suffer. And, you know, we'd go on to find out that it wasn't just these 18 kids of the Little Princess Children's Home. He's probably done this with about 1,200 children. And, you know,
how did he view what he was doing?
You know, this is a great question. He thinks of himself as some kind of savior, because there are other traffickers as well in his network, and they think, oh, well, we're taking these children away from poverty, and I think that they don't think too deeply on that. I mean, clearly, they're not only breaking the law, but they're putting these children's lives at risk. I mean, when children don't survive when they're in your care, clearly you are doing something evil. So it's hard to say, but for sure, he's able to convince these people who don't, you know, have a lot of access to information or anything else that what he's doing is the right thing. And most of these parents never are able to follow up with their kids, so they don't know. They have to live on hope. And people say, well, what happened to Golka at the end of the book, this evil guy? And he's actually now the head of a political party in Nepal.
Hmm. To what extent do you empathize with the parents of these children who gave their own children up? You ever think that what you might do in those circumstances? You are a father now as well.
Well, this is the point, right? I mean, when I went out and did this, I was not a father. I was not married or anything else. I meet my wife in this book. It's part of the story, I suppose. But, you know, I was really frustrated with the parents. I was angry with them. I was, you know, thinking, how can you do something so irrational, so reckless with your children? And that's how I sort of approached it, you know, when I first went into the mountains and met these families. But after I had my son, who's now 2 years old, and I have a new daughter as well, I suddenly also began to understand what the parents were going through. I mean, this is not like they were making money off this. They were giving up everything just to try to save their child. Clearly, they thought they were doing the right thing. And to understand that this person had lost their child and had just had to live with that, that they had given up their child and been duped and been conned, is something that, as a father, I don't know how I'd live with.
Now, in recent years, there've been a number of books, memoirs, experiences of certain authors that have proven to be exaggerated, or to put it bluntly, just plain not the truth.
Yeah.
Did you receive any scrutiny for this book? And did you feel sort of the shadow of those books and people wondering, was this all true?
Yes, in the very beginning, a little bit. When I never intended to write a book. I'd been keeping a blog for many years, and then there was a story in Reader's Digest about what I had done. And when I was approached to write the book, I turned it down. I wasn't interested in writing a book because there was other things going on with my life and trying to run this organization. But when I finally did, got a great response from various publishing houses. And one of the questions they were asking was, how can we verify this? Because of that exact question. And I said, well, the verification is kind of the easy part for a couple of reasons. I mean, first of all, I was, keeping a blog about this, just a little blog without, with no intention of sort of ever writing a book or anything. So all that was publicly available anyway, sort of essentially my notes from all the years. But beyond that, I had a camera with me almost at every moment. So all the sort of the moments where you think, oh, well, did that really happen? I have literally photos of that moment, and a lot of them actually appear in the book. And beyond that, there's two sort of important things, I think. I mean, first of all, I was almost never alone doing this. I wasn't just sort of like wandering through the mountains by myself. I was always with somebody else that could always sort of corroborate and verify the story. And for me, the most important thing was when I finished the manuscript of the book, the first thing I did was I sent it to the children so they could read like the advanced copy of it so that they could see, this, because kids will just tell it to you straight. They'll say, well, it didn't really happen like this. And all their only complaint was that, I didn't tell sort of some other stories. But, this was, I checked it with so many different people precisely because I was worried, about that. Not that I was going to exaggerate or lie. I mean, clearly I wasn't. But what if I remembered something wrong? That was my big fear, which is why I was able to check it with all these other people. So it did undergo that scrutiny. I love it when people do scrutinize it. I love it when people come to me about it because it means that they're actually, asking the proper questions. Did this really happen? Are you really doing the right thing out there? So I really do appreciate the scrutiny. I welcome it. I enjoy it. I like talking to people about it. But we do actually happen to have a lot of backup evidence on it.
What kind of dent have you made in human trafficking in Nepal with this organization?
Yeah, it's only been around about 5 years. For me, seeing the problem out there, it always feels like a drop in the bucket, And but the fact is that what we started off doing, I started off looking for the families of 24 kids, just me. Again, it took me 4 weeks. It was a brutal experience, but we realized that there was no shortcut to it. We had to do that. And since that time, we've found, just walking through the mountains with backpacks on, we've found the families of about 400 children and been able to reconnect about 400 children with their families. So we're proud of that, but there's so much more to do. And these are kids. I mean, this is an urgent situation. These are kids that are literally starving to death. They're literally kids that are working as slaves. They're literally kids that have been, were put up for international adoption. One of the things we did was when we found out that a child's parents had death certificates, we would take copies of the death certificates and go out to the villages. And more times than not, we'd find those families alive, and I would take a photo of the families, the father holding his own death certificate so that child could not be adopted. When you look at it holistically, we have a long way to go. We're a very small organization. We rely on just small donations from people. But, we are good at what we do, I have to say, and we're the only ones doing it. So that's how we sort of, get up and work in the morning, essentially.
When you experience the lives of these children and have for many years been acquainted with many of them, changed their lives, did it change the way you saw childhood in the United States?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that it changed in that I started to realize that kids were at heart the same everywhere. They are just incredibly resilient. All they want to do is just know that somebody cares about them, that somebody's out there to protect them. And you see that kind of light going out in their eyes when they don't think that. And I just find that, the kids here and the kids there, they're all equally resilient. I mean, you put our kids here and raise them in some developing world or something, they're survivors. They'll get by, but we have to give them a chance because what they live on is hope. And without that, I don't care what situation, how rich or poor you are, a child has to know that that child is being taken care of and that somebody's looking out for them. Otherwise, they just don't have a lot to live for.
You and your organization, Connor, have changed hundreds of lives of Nepalese children. Have you ever considered how your life would have not been changed had you not volunteered at Little Princes?
Yeah, I shudder to think. First of all, it just changed my life here. I mean, I met basically the woman of my dreams out there doing this, and I now have a family. But more importantly to me, it allowed me to see outside of myself and understand. You know, when we talk about seeing how the other half lives, it's not the other half. I mean, it's the other 90% or something of the world, how it looks. And that helps me. It helps me to sort of, keep on going with this organization. It also helps me to understand that, when you're helping to save one child, that child could be your child. And it just gives me a better appreciation of what's going on in the rest of the world. And when I have a chance to talk to middle schoolers or high schoolers, that's the message that I try to bring. It's just, look, just get out there and volunteer for a day. Whatever you do with it after that is up to you. But this is the most important thing.
Connor Grennan, I want to thank you very much for this conversation.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Connor Grennan is the founder of Next Generation Nepal and the author of the memoir Little Princes. That's our program for today. River to River is produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer. Technical support from Dennis Reese. And remember, podcasts and on-demand audio of River to River available by going to iowapublicradio.org. And we always welcome your comments and questions about this program. You can contact us anytime at this email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.